particles, right?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I'm thinking about the number of stars in the galaxy.
Dude, there's dark
energy. Dark energy. Dark energy.
Dark energy.
I've got it right in my coffee cup.
In that coffee cup, dark energy.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Early Morning Coffee at CERN. My name is Stephen Goldfarb.
And my name is Joni Pham.
And we have a really nice show for you today. It's on a topic which is perhaps one of our favorites here at CERN. That's the discovery of the Higgs boson. And believe it or not, it's been about 12 years now since that discovery. With us to talk about the discovery are a couple of people who were there at the time working on the physics. So we have Heather Gray next to me, who was working on the ATLAS experiment. You're from UC Berkeley?
Yes, right? That's right.
And Andre David, who's from the CMS experiment, other experiment that was also working on the discovery of the Higgs boson. Both of them announced together the discovery back then, on July 4th, it was. Andre, you're a CERN physicist, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Very good. So let's get started right away. I think it'd be nice to hear from you, maybe a brief introduction of yourself, Heather. What brought you here to CERN, and what have you been working on?
Sure, happy to do that. So I think the first time I came to CERN was, gosh, almost 20 years ago now to do it.
You were a kid. You were a kid.
I was a kid. Yeah. Okay. It was as a CERN summer student. And so I'm from South Africa. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, they had money to bring one summer student from the whole of Africa to CERN for the summer program. And sort of a month or two before the program was going to start, they didn't have anybody. So my professor at the time, you know, came and said, would you like to go to CERN? I said, okay.
So they took only the very best volunteer, is what you're saying.
They took a volunteer at the time.
A volunteer. Happened to be the very best, of course.
No, but it's actually quite funny because before that, I thought I was going to be a theoretical physicist, as do many when they're young. Mm-hmm. But somehow being at CERN for the summer and seeing all the experiments and really seeing experimental physics, I was an experimentalist and that was done for after that.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And you've stuck with it. You're an associate professor?
Yeah, right? I'm an associate professor at UC Berkeley. I actually have a sort of joint appointment, which means I'm half at UC Berkeley and half at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, which is great because it means I only have to teach a half load compared to everybody else. And I get to come visit CERN and do things like
that. I'm sure you love teaching, though, but you love experiment as well, right?
I like both of them.
Excellent.
To do it. But no, it gives extra flexibility.
Uh-huh. Very good. Andre.
Well, I hail from Portugal, and I was a student. I was working on theoretical nuclear physics and microtechnology, so making chips. And then somebody told me, Andre, you're not really good at this theoretical stuff, but I know of someone who has something going on at CERN, and I didn't really know what CERN was. And I came here for 2 weeks at the end of the year 2000, and I did get hooked. I mean, just seeing all of the kinds of things that are done here. So I've been here for the last 24 years working in different types of experiments.
And you were also a kid when you came here, I guess.
We were all kids at some
point. We were all kids. We were students at some point. So another question for you, Andre. On July 4th, 2012, where were you?
It depends on the time. I think that when the day started, I was still here in Building 40, where we have a lot of our offices, trying to make sure that all the last dots, you know, all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed on the slide deck that was going to be shown. And then I went for a walk to look at the people who were by the seminar room, the main auditorium here at CERN. There was already a big queue and people were playing cards. This was like a sort of a wild camp going on. And then during the day, after taking a shower, I came back and I was in the main auditorium
for the announcement. Just so that everybody knows, it was a very exciting time. We knew something was going to be shown, right? It was the result of our searches, and we've been searching for the Higgs boson for many years, actually, before the LHC. And so I was tricked. Okay, I wasn't here. I was in Australia for the conference where it was originally going to be announced, and the CERN Council, in their wisdom, decided that it should be presented at CERN. Were you here for that?
Nope.
No, where were you?
I was not. It was quite amusing. I was actually there's an annual meeting of Nobel laureates in Lindau in Germany, where they get together, you know, a large number of Nobel laureates and also some young students to do it. So I was there at the time.
Being a Nobel laureate, you were
obviously a Nobel laureate at the time. No, I was the young student, of course. Uh-huh. But it was quite funny because it was the middle of the program. Of the meeting. And we sort of said, you know, we think we should broadcast the seminar. We went to the organizers and they said, no. The other Nobel laureate said, no, they refused to cancel their talks. Oh, yeah. So me and a couple others, there were about 10 of us initially, we set up a sort of bootleg setup with, you know, a bunch of computers and things because the connection kept dropping because so many people were connected to what was going on at CERN. So when one died, we'd switch to the next one. And we kind of got a growing following, including a number of Nobel laureates watching our bootleg
I guess
connection.
So. People felt there was something exciting going on.
Yeah.
Joni, where were you?
So 12 years ago, I was still an undergraduate student at University of Melbourne. And at that time, when the announcement was made, it was made almost like simultaneously, right? Like one at the auditorium here at CERN and the other at the International Conference of High Energy Physics in Melbourne. And University of Melbourne was one of the organizers. Mm-hmm. So I was begging my physics professor, Roger Rasoon, to somehow sneak me in the conference. That's where I saw you the first time. You look a lot younger than you are now.
I was younger. You were the same age, I think, but I was younger. That's true. I said I got tricked, right? And that trick happened because I guess it was in December of 2011. Mm-hmm. We had a hint that there was something in our data, and I got very excited by this hint. We always get tricked by Three Sigma events. But in this case, things look lined up. It looked like we might have something. And so I booked my flight right away. I knew that the next major conference, there was going to be a presentation, and that was at Melbourne, the IChep that was organized there. And so we were far away. But fortunately, we had this nice webcast. It was done in both places simultaneously, and we could watch it.
Was it in the middle of the night in Melbourne
that
you were doing it?
No, actually, we managed it so that it was early. It was done early. Here was done in the morning.
Yeah, it was
here.
Late there.
Okay.
And it was late in the, it was almost like 5 o'clock or something like that in the evening. Wasn't too unreasonable.
Yeah, it's not like the watch parties that I've seen from the US where they had pajama like things to watch.
Yeah, they weren't so happy that we arranged it to be in the morning here because in the States it was whatever, 2 a.m. or whenever that they had to watch it. But yeah, there people were in their pajamas watching from Fermilab and other places in the US. It was a very exciting time. Which brings a natural question. Why? Why do you think, why was this so exciting for us? What was so important about the discovery of this particular particle? We've discovered particles before. Why was the Higgs boson an important discovery for our field?
The God particle, right?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Okay. That was Chetna, our producer, in the back here, asking if it's called the God particle. So this terrible name, a name we don't like, because we didn't really call it that, it came about because of a book that was put out, which is a good book, by the way, if you want to read more about the Higgs boson. Leon Lederman and Dick Teresi, they wrote this book together. And the story that I heard, and it was only sort of secondhand, someone who knew Leon Lederman, who told me this, so I hope I got this right. But Leon Lederman had just given a lecture to his students, and he was talking about symmetry. Symmetries are extremely important in physics, right? We look for those all the time because we seem to find bit by bit that some forces which we think were separate are actually two sides of the same coin, electricity and magnetism, electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. It turns out you can make a theory that combines them. And so he was showing this to his class and he said, it could be, maybe we can dream that one day all of the forces will come together and maybe there'll be just one particle and an explanation that describes the movements of this particle. And we could call it, and he said, well, let's call it the God particle. So he'd made this lecture to his class and Dick was in the room and saw this. And then they went together and they were talking about this manuscript, this book that they were about to publish. And Dick said, look, they've asked us to give a working title to this book. And Dick said, I propose that we call it the God particle. And Leon Lederman said, no, absolutely not. And Dick said, now, hold on now. Every single book that I've ever written in the past, whenever they ask us for a title, to propose a title for it, they never accept my working title. And so if we call it this, it's guaranteed it won't be called that. Unfortunately, this time, the publishers decided to call it the God Particle, and to which Leon Letterman said it would have been much better to call it the Goddamn Particle, because we've been searching for it. It's really hard to predict where to find. We had no idea what its mass would be. So there you go, Chetan. I hope you're happy. We laid that to rest. No one is ever going to call it that again for eternity, okay? But let's move on. This particular particle, which got that horrible nickname, the Higgs boson, why is it so important to our current theory?
So we have this model which describes all the particles and their interactions, the standard model. And this is something that was come up with by a bunch of theorists half a century ago, a little bit longer. Well, there were various pieces that came along. And in this theory, provides a description of everything we know, so all the particles, all their interactions. However, it has one problem, which would be that the particles, certain particles don't have any masses. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem because we have nice experimental measurements which showed us that the particles do have mass to do it. And so one way to think about the Higgs boson, or indeed the Higgs mechanism, which is kind of how it does it, is it's a mathematical trick. It basically allows us to preserve the symmetries of the theory, which you need the particles to be massless, yet for them at the same time to have mass, as we know experimentally, to do it. And so it's really critical in the standard model because it resolves this apparent contradiction between, you know, what the theory says we needed to have and then what we saw in the experiment.
And even inside the theory, it's completely unique. It's the only elementary particle that is a scalar. Ooh. So it basically...
What's that?
Exactly. So I knew you were going to go there. It means it has no notion of direction. It just permeates. There's a field that permeates the whole of the universe. And different particles interact differently with it. But it's the only particle in the theory that we have right now with these properties. There could be others, but right now this is what is needed for the theory to work. But the theory, I mean, it's very beautiful, the mathematical edifice for which this Higgs boson was created. And then a little later came an idea of, hey, since we already have this thing in, and this is Steven Weinberg, why don't we just write a few more terms and insert a lot of arbitrary parameters to give masses to other particles, like the leptons, like the electron, the muon, and the quarks. And so you end up having like this one single actor playing two very different roles in one single theory. And that's really, really strange how the two things are mixed together. So the Higgs participates in that beautiful symmetry breaking that Heather was talking about. And then it also participates in you get a coupling, you get a mass, which is it has a very ad hoc feeling.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. So that messy part of the standard model, that's the part that I study because it bothers me a lot, right? I really don't like the fact that for all these individual particles, we have these different parameters. And so if I want to take a bet of, you know, where should we go and have a look for something that might be different, it's there. And so where my research is trying to go through and measure some of the more tricky ones in that area. In particular, I'm looking to see if the Higgs boson interacts with charm quarks.
Okay. We've been seeing that it interacts with the more massive quarks, the more massive elementary particles, more strongly than
Because
with
that's exactly
ones.
That's exactly what comes out of the theory, is that if you interact more strongly with the Higgs boson, you end up appearing as having a larger mass.
Okay.
So or the other way around.
Yeah, okay.
It does become circular, but that's okay.
I agree. Wait, because this is important. Because it's like when you measure the mass of a particle, you're measuring the mass of the particle. And that's the thing that you measure experimentally. Then you take that mass and you can infer what is the coupling, which the coupling is a theory parameter. So you can go that way. It's a good point.
So the coupling is how strongly it interacts.
Yes.
With other things. So it's interesting. I should actually step back a second and say, you know, we've referred to this as the Higgs boson all the way through this. So it was proposed by Peter Higgs. There were others involved, right? In fact, there was a long list of people who were
involved. This is my second least favorite question about the Higgs boson. You went for you got the first one.
I got them. I'm going for it. I'm going to get them all. I'm going all the way down the list.
You got the God question first.
Yeah, exactly. To do it.
Well, I took that over. Okay, so you did. But now, who would like to? There's a list of people.
That's why it was something. I think probably there's a long list of people, and I think probably the reason for that is that it was a natural thought to have at the time in terms of the theoretical development. And that's why it turned out that a number of people came up with it independently. This is at least my understanding of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so part of the math was actually taken from solid state physics. Mm-hmm. Because there you actually have like things condensating together and behaving as one. Mm-hmm. And the idea here was to do some of that, let's say, mathematical machinery, but for the elementary particles. And you do have people who contributed before Peter Higgs, mm-hmm. but then Peter Higgs crucially got his paper rejected. Mm-hmm. And then he added a paragraph, and it's that paragraph is absolutely crucial because it's a paragraph that says, and this particle will have a mass. Uh-huh. And so that's the thing that actually makes it distinctive. And I think that's the reason why we call it the Higgs boson and not the Brautigan-Lehr Higgs boson. But we do call it the Brautigan-Lehr Higgs mechanism because it's the underlying symmetry breaking mechanism that Heather was mentioning. That one does involve a bit more. But then it was not over there because once you start adding these ingredients, but you still need to make a recipe that does not kill you when you try to eat it. So there were other ingredients that were contributed by other people, mm-hmm. like, for instance, making sure that you can still have massive particles, but a photon that is pretty massless from mm-hmm. what we can observe. Mm-hmm. So getting all of those things cooked together in a way that you can make reasonable predictions took the effort of many people and taking mm-hmm. hints from many different places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you mentioned before, right, the fermionic side, right? So we were talking about the Higgs being a boson. Particles mm-hmm. can be two types. They can be bosons and fermions. For that came kind of separately. Mm-hmm. And that was largely, I believe, from Steven Weinberg.
Yeah.
He had a very nice paper.
2.5 pages long.
I know. I mean, you look back at these papers, even Peter Higgs's paper, right? I think it's what,
it was very short.
Four pages. And
we need
15
pages for labeling the number of the physicists, the names of the physicists who were involved.
Wait. Please do not mix theoretical work with experimental work.
Right. Exactly.
Because one of the things that I really admire about theorists is their ability to just go walk in the Alps and come back and write 4 pages with a completely new idea that then we have to go and build a detector and get thousands of people together to build these detectors to disprove that idea. Mm-hmm. But there's a very different exercise of working together as experimentalists.
But don't forget, when they took that walk, it was because they'd read our papers from before that showed them that we had found some patterns or some particle or something.
Sometimes they just go off, and it's good. They just go off in their own direction.
Since you mentioned like Higgs' paper in 1964, and as far as I remember, he didn't propose like any experiment that can verify his theory. So why did the scientific community take him seriously and decided to spend like billions of years on building the detectors to search for the boson?
Well, I don't think they did immediately to do it, right? So, I mean, this was in the 60s, which is now 60 years ago, to do it. There was another paper, I think it came out in the 80s, if I remember correctly.
The
one of Ellis and Mary Kay. To do it, which is called On the Experimental Profile of the Higgs Boson or something like that.
Yes, it has this beautiful coda.
Exactly. And the coda, basically, in this paper, I think it was the 80s. I could be slightly wrong about it.
It's a phenomenological profile. Yes.
Yes. That's the one. Mm-hmm. It basically says we do not encourage large experimental searches for such a boson. But the paper basically is out, you know, here's the Higgs, here's how you might look for it and things like that.
If it has this mass, it looks like this. If it has that mass, it looks like that.
That was quite useful. And they discouraged us simply because it's so hard, right? It's not easy to. It wasn't an easy task to find.
It was hard, and the mass was unknown, which is something Andre, I think, already mentioned, which meant that it's not like you could build an experiment to go find this particle of a specific mass. Yeah. You had to be able to cover this entire range, and if it was infinite, you would maybe not find it at all to do it. But then subsequently, we added extra constraints, which able to sort of narrow down the range where we were doing. So I think what the answer I'm trying to give is it was a bit of a process. So it wasn't like, you know, Peter Higgs had this idea and they said, okay, let's go and do a 60-year program to find the Higgs boson to do it. They started actually by exploring the Standard Model because there were a number of these particles they had to discover along the way. And then as things were discovered, how to search for it became more clear. And then the decision was taken to do it.
And when you come back to the billions, so one of the things that the LHC had going for it is that you either find the Higgs boson or we would be operating, we would be doing collisions at such an energy that the theory becomes invalid. And then something else has to come up. Mm. So out of these two outcomes, we did find something that looks like a Higgs boson, which is great. So we now have a new tool with which to hammer nature and get the truth out. But it was called a no-lose theorem, and that was critical for actually going and spending the money. But I don't think Peter Higgs even thought about spending the money. So back in the 1960s, they were trying to figure out how to make the math work. How can you make the observations, how can you reconcile the observations with what the theory is saying? Because in the beginning, before Brout and Glare, Higgs, all of these guys, all of these people got the math worked out, the theory just said all particles are massless. Mm. And then it was clear that they weren't, because we had experimental evidence that they weren't. Mm. So they figured out that problem, and then there were other problems with the theory. And then at some point, we reached the point where we could build an accelerator that would make collisions, that if there is no Higgs boson, then the calculations start giving answers like infinity, and infinity is a very large number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I actually really like that. We were very lucky to have this no-lose theorem. It's very rare that you can build an experiment like that. But it was even, I mean, when you say the theory breaks, it was quantum mechanics that would break, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you know, the Higgs would not be there or something. It would be that something very fundamental in our understanding of physics would have been wrong.
And that would have been great. This is something that, it would have been a challenging time.
No. I agree with what you're saying, but most people, so some people panic. When there's a crisis, some people panic, some people calm down. I don't know how to put it.
And they focus on.
Exactly. So that's the thing. So when things break, it's an actual opportunity to go and try and understand why doesn't it work? Because the measurements don't lie. The measurements are statements about nature. Mm-hmm. Then how can we explain the measurements if we no longer have a way of explaining them? We have to find a different way of explaining them.
This could be like Michelson-Morley and not finding the ether. Mm. And then you have someone like Einstein come along and say, of course, there's no ether. Here's another solution. You know? We do like it when our physical theories are broken and we find something wrong with them. And we spend a lot of time trying to find what's wrong with our theories, right?
Were either of you part of the LHC bet about the Higgs boson?
Oh,
do you remember?
I know. I heard what.
So it was a bet about whether or not, or was it a bet about the?
So it was a pool, right? And I think it was 10 francs or something like that. And basically, you could bet on do we find the Higgs boson or not, and if so, what mass it would have.
And who won?
I don't actually know that question.
Well, we have to look that up.
I know he did the poll, so I can write to him and ask him.
Okay, we're going to give it a challenge to our audience. They can put that into our comments on their YouTube channel. If you find out who won the bet, the pool, as you say, of the Higgs mass, that'd be interesting to know.
I bet on no Higgs boson.
Oh, you bet on no Higgs boson?
Yeah.
Really?
That's what I wanted.
That's interesting.
Since you brought up like the topic about the mass of the Higgs boson, and like we didn't know prior like what was the mass of a Higgs boson, right? And it made it so hard that we called the goddamn particles. But I wonder, because like I think that we already have like the Standard Model, which is a very good theory, like the best theory we have so far. And the data from the lab, the Large Electron Positron Collider. So we already had the constraint on the mass of the Higgs, like before the Large Hadron Collider come into play. So why was it still very hard, and why was it like searching for the needle in the hay?
Oh gosh, there's a lot of different
a lot of questions
all in one. Yeah. So maybe I'll go back to what we knew about it, right? So LEP, which was the Large Electron Positron Collider, it actually found something that some people thought might have been a Higgs boson right at the end. So there was all sorts of excitement, right? There was a little excess to do it, and should we extend it? Should they shut down in the LHC, et cetera, to do it? But in the end, after reanalysis, you know, they put a constraint. I think it was 114 GeV, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So that was a lower bound, and that was super clear. Yeah. But then what you were talking about, like the standard model, this is more complex. So what this was is like taking all the different parameters in the standard model, doing a global fit and saying, are they all consistent? Mm-hmm. And with that, you could put a kind of, you know, this is around where the Higgs should be. Also, and this is sort of more at the same time as the LHC, I would say, the Tevatron started to give some bounds as well in the mid kind of range on the Higgs boson. So we had that as well. But I think one of the reasons why we still weren't sure about the mass is that it's still possible you could change the standard model a little bit, and then that whole fit wouldn't make sense, right? So you still needed to look over that full range. At least that's how I kind of thought about it. So sorry, I know that's not exactly your question. I'm answering the first half.
That's a good point, though, because we spend a lot of effort up to this day still measuring the standard model parameters as precisely as we possibly can. Actually, for some of us at least, hoping there'll be disagreement at some point, because there's many things that are not in the standard model that are not explained by the standard model.
So just because the standard model says so doesn't mean it happens in nature like that. No. I mean, for all the successes of the standard model, it explains what, 5% of the universe? I mean, it's sometimes hard to hold this thought in my mind. Wow, it's a beautiful theory. I work with it every day. It makes predictions. I can go and measure things. Yeah. And at the same time, it's only 1/20th of everything that's out there.
You're referring to the fact that there's a lot of the universe, about a quarter is dark matter, which we have no clue what it is. And then about 2/3 is dark energy. There's dark matter.
I've got the dark energy. I've got right it right in my
in
coffee
cup. In that coffee cup, dark energy. And that's like a huge portion, the amount of energy, whatever is making our universe expand by a lot, more and more, right? It's not just the expansion, more and more. And we have no, even less of a clue. If you can say you have no clue and then even less of a clue.
Yeah, if a physicist calls it dark, it's just a measure of the ignorance. It's
exactly. It's, exactly.
We just don't know.
So we don't get that. I do want to mention, and by the way, of the 5%, we don't get gravity. Too, right? So this is even of that, we don't have a complete understanding. But I did want to mention a few names because we've said their names several times. Robert Brault and François Englert, say their full names. They along with, it was interesting, the story that you said that Peter Higgs had first put his paper out and then it got rejected simply, you know, by the CERN referees, I think it was.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. There's a whole history of that in a book that I cannot recall the name right now, but there's a whole explanation of how it happened. And of course, humans were involved in that. It's not just...
We're stuck with humans, I think, for now. Until whales can help us out with our papers, I think we're stuck with humans. But also, I mean, François Englert and Robert, they then got their paper published first, but then came in the Higgs paper. And the reason we call it the Higgs boson, of course, is because he included the fact that there was a particle associated with the field, which everybody knew. If there's a field, there's a particle, there's a particle, there's a field. And I can feel a question coming from Chetna about the Higgs boson. Do you have a question about the Higgs boson, Chetna?
Yeah, enough of the Higgs. Let's talk about what's the boson? Where did it come from?
The boson. So that's a very important point. And this was actually brought up. I do remember when there was the discovery. There were some complaints that came mainly out of India asking, like, how come we're not talking about Bose? And Bose was a person for whom a boson, which has a certain
when bosons get together, they distribute themselves in a certain way.
Exactly. And when fermions, named after
they don't get together.
They don't get together.
So they distribute themselves in a different way.
So bosons tend to be the force-carrying particles, we can call them. Excitations of, they're all excitations of fields. in quantum field theory. We're not going to go into quantum field theory yet here, but darn. but anyway, yeah, there's different kinds of statistics. There was Bose-Einstein statistics and
Fermi-Dirac.
And Fermi-Dirac statistics. So boson was very important. In my response, there were some people who complained. They said, how come Higgs is capitalized and boson is not capitalized? And my claim is that it's even a greater honor to have your name used with a small letter, without the capital letter. That means it's common. And bosons are very important and common throughout throughout our field. Bosons are integral. Photons, these photons heating up our room here and giving us light, they are bosons, and boson is not capitalized for that. And same with fermions. So there's Bose-Einstein statistics, which describe the bosons, and there's Fermi-Dirac statistics, which describe the fermions, which tend to be the sort of matter of particles as opposed to the force-carrying particles of bosons. Okay, so we got the boson point in, and Chetna's happy about that. I did want to mention, there's a few things that when you guys want to get more information, there's some nice books out there. We already mentioned the God Particle book, of course. I really liked this very short book, easy to read, by Lisa Randall, called The Higgs Discovery, simply. There's also a new one that came out by Matt Stressler. I don't know if you guys know Matt. He's a theorist, and he wrote a book that's called Waves on an Impossible Sea.
Yeah, so I actually interviewed Matt in Berkeley recently about his book to do it. And what's interesting about this book is he doesn't like the way we explain the Higgs boson and the Higgs mechanism to the public. Okay. He thinks that we use metaphors that are wrong do it. And so the basic idea of the book, he's right, of course, is to actually explain it from scratch. How things really work without you know, using any metaphors and things like that. So he's deeply critical of all the metaphors we've been using today.
Okay, Matt, I will read your book. I will read your book. I want to see it because I back in 2012, I was working as our outreach coordinator for Atlas. Full disclosure, I'm on Atlas. My good friend Dave Barney was the outreach coordinator for CMS. And we got together and we made a TED Ed animation, which was a lot of fun. And it was all about the fact that whenever we asked all of our friends how to describe the Higgs boson and the Higgs field, they would go through all of these different metaphors. We finally settled on one, which I'm sure Matt won't like, which was I have a cherry being dropped into a shake, and the splash of the cherry in the shake, that splash, it's an injection of energy into a field. That splash, that excitation of the field was, well, I mean, that was the best we could do.
That sounds more delicious than the one I heard of dropping a stone on a lake.
Yeah, yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And it's true that, you know, we live in this, we're, you know, all macroscopic, and we all move non-relativistically. And so to actually even comprehend this is perhaps beyond our imagination. But I'm interested to see how Matt made it accessible. Did he make it accessible, do you feel?
I found it very interesting to read. So there's a lot about relativity. So he starts with relativity, right? And sort of explaining, you know, how it works and things like that. And no equations, by the way. So,
that's nice.
Yeah,
that's nice.
No, it's a fun book.
That's always good. Let's move on. So we found it. We've already declared victory. We've found the Higgs boson. So then we just turn off the LHC and go home, right? This has been asked. Why? Well, you know, why? You know, why do you carry on? What have we been doing for the past 12 years with this Higgs boson? Has it taught us more? And what have we learned more about it?
Well, of course, that would be great, because then we could, you know, just sit at home and drink coffee. And it would really suck. No, so the truth is, of course, is we found a particle consistent with the standard model Higgs boson. I believe that was the precise statement, which meant actually we had a whole bunch of things we needed to know, right? We needed to know, was it the standard model Higgs boson? We needed to know what was its mass to do it. But the first one, this is it the standard model Higgs boson, that actually gives you a whole bunch of other questions, right? Mm-hmm. Andre talked a whole lot about all the different particles that it needs to interact with. We needed to measure each of those. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if some of them were just not there, then there was something wrong with the theory. To do it, we had to measure its mass. We talked about, you know, how we didn't know the mass at all. And then people came up with some clever things, for example, probing the width of the Higgs boson, which was something that was meant to be impossible at the LHC, like three orders of magnitude impossible. But yet, I mean, there are some assumptions, but it has been
quantum mechanical trickery.
I should mention orders of magnitude. We use that all the time.
Yep.
Three orders of magnitude means you have three zeros after the one, so it's 1,000 times away from
the Higgs boson is 1,000 times narrower than the resolution of our detectors.
Right.
So our detectors measure things with only a finite resolution, and the Higgs boson width is much smaller than that. So we had to resort to quantum mechanical trickery.
Quantum mechanical trickery.
Yep, okay. that's a beautiful way to describe it.
And were we able to measure that width?
Yes, to do it. Well, we're at small number of significance, but we're starting to probe the width to do it. Unfortunately, consistent with standard model. But we're not done, by the way. So we have not measured everything yet. A big thing that's missing is one of the funny things about the Higgs boson is that it needs to interact with itself without changing itself. This comes from some of the, it has mass, and the Higgs boson gives mass, needs to do it. So we need to probe that, and there's a way to do it where you need to look for events containing two Higgs bosons, but they're very rare.
The di-Higgs searches.
These are the di-Higgs searches, so that needs to be done. There are also a number of these decays of the Higgs boson, which is just, you know, the particles it produces when it disappears that we haven't been able to measure just yet to do it. We also need to look for ones that it shouldn't do. Particles it could decay to. So we're sort of, I don't know, we've got a basic profile of it, but there's still big pieces missing. That's sort of how I would see it.
So we were talking earlier about the fermions, like the quarks and the leptons. So for instance, an example of a forbidden decay is like the Higgs boson decaying into a muon and an electron. It can go into an electron and a positron, a muon and anti-muon, a B quark and an anti-B quark, a C quark and anti-C quark, all of these things. But mixing things around, it should not be able to mix things. So indeed, one of the biggest thrusts of, let's say, the Higgs physics program is not only going and probing these interactions if it decays into these lighter and lighter particles, because those are more rarefied interactions, they are not as strong. It's also this question of how does the Higgs interact with itself? And that has some interesting consequences, connections, because it connects to the vacuum structure of the universe. And, you know, this sounds very arcane. It is a bit arcane. But basically, at least for me as an experimentalist, what is important is that the standard model says it must be exactly like this. So the standard model says that this potential of vacuum energy in the universe must have a specific, very, very specific shape. And you do not really, you cannot deviate from it without breaking the standard model. So if we are able to measure how the Higgs boson interacts with itself, we can check whether or not that is what is realized in nature. So measuring the shape of this potential becomes something that the Higgs boson allows us to do. And so it's a big thrust, not just for the LHC, so we've barely touched the surface at the LHC, but for the upgrades of the LHC that will start in 2029.
Just to explain how the LHC works, where right now we collide bunches. It's not really a continuous beam of protons, but we collide bunches of protons every 25 nanoseconds at the different places where we have the detectors. So there's four collision points, and these bunches go through each other. Each bunch is a galaxy of protons, right? Roughly 100 billion protons. So you have Andromeda, the Milky Way, passing through each other every 25 nanoseconds, roughly speaking.
Yeah, no. I'm thinking about the number of stars in a galaxy, yeah.
Yeah, it's roughly 100 billion. And actually, Andromeda and Milky Way are going to do this, but we probably won't be.
Yeah, but it goes slower. It's not almost at the speed of light.
Much more slowly. And they predict none of the stars are actually going to hit each other. Probably they won't, even though those are pretty dense galaxies. But in our case, we really put these bunches together as densely as possible, which you have to do because they don't want to be together. They're protons. They have charges that make them push apart. And they go through each other. And as tight as we squeeze them, as well as we focus them and bring them through each other, we get, as Andrea said, about 60 right? That actually, on average, about 60 will actually go through each other, will pass through each other. And then of that, less than that will actually interact and give us something that's interesting.
Yeah, and we call it luminosity, because you make the beams as narrow as possible, because mm-hmm. you are saying it's like they are as bright as possible.
Right.
So like the brighter they are, the more collisions you get and the more luminous mm-hmm. the interaction region.
So I wanted to clarify one thing. We don't actually want these 60 collisions to happen, right? So what want is we would like our rare processes, right, like Higgs bosons, to happen as much as possible.
On demand.
And all the background ones to stay away.
But the problem is, like, increasing the rate of those processes has a side effect of having these extra collisions, and it makes our life harder because we have to actually search through those extra ones to find out the ones that we really want.
When something interesting, we label as interesting, triggers our detectors, we call the system a trigger, like taking a picture. It's because something came out from this passing of these two bunches, like a muon coming out, or electron, or some energy, or some balance, or something that we've put into our menu of things we want to look for. And then you've got all of these other collisions that happened at the same time, and then you have to sort out from that. So that's what we're going to be going up for in 3-4 years' time or something like that. We will actually go up to, we hope, if we get everything on time. And in that case, we can look for things which are much more rare, and we can look for maybe Higgs bosons interacting with muons, for example, or transforming to muons. Maybe we'll have that at the end of this run.
Yeah, that's coming. Thanks to a lot of work. I mean, Heather knows this better than anyone here. There's a lot of techniques from machine learning that have been helping us distinguish between like what a beauty quark looks like in our detector and a charm quark looks like in our detector. Mm-hmm. And it's very titillating that we are being able to tease out all these charming signals.
Yeah, no, this is kind of one of the things that motivates me. The best way to get me to do something is tell me it's impossible. Uh-huh. Then I like to go and solve the problem to do it. But you're right. It's actually amazing just how much better things are in certain places than we predicted, right? We found, and I think it comes, there's a whole chunk from machine learning, like you were saying, but I also think that people get clever in a wide variety of ways. And if you sort of compare, you know, what people thought we would do and what we actually do, we do far better than any of the predictions that we had. Like, you know, we're probably going to see Higgs to Mu in run 3, looks like that, at least with combination between Atlas and CMS. And then Dihiggs, we're getting awfully close to do it, whereas that initially it was maybe we'd see it at the high luminosity LHC to do it. So it's pretty cool. I find there's something very exciting about how well we actually end up doing our physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one interesting phenomenon here is that when you turn on the detector is also partly unknown. So with time, you learn all its features, the good parts, the not so great parts, and you learn how to calibrate it and, you know, extract more reliable information from it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we get smarter at figuring out the detectors that we build.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you one more thing before we end this, about the future. And can be just predictions, what you want to happen. I mean, the Higgs boson, what we've established, it interacts with any elementary particle that has a mass. So far, I mean, that's proposed, and that's what we're seeing. One thought about this dark matter, for example, is that there's this stuff out there, which we've seen really clearly. Vera Rubin saw it. He actually calculated first how much dark matter there was in our galaxy, and since then we've mapped out this existence of dark matter all over our universe, right? And one possibility is that that's an elementary particle. So if it were an elementary particle, does it necessarily mean that we will be able to find it if we look hard enough through the Higgs boson or not?
So I take exception to the notion if you'll find it if you look hard enough. The way I see things is that if you don't look, you will not find.
Yeah.
That's definitely the case. Now, it, as you were pointing out, the fact that this Higgs boson speaks or talks with many different types of particles, you know, we've discussed the bosons and the fermions, perhaps it also interacts with dark matter. If dark matter is an elementary particle, the standard model really has no allowance for dark matter particles. Mm-hmm. But again, one of the reasons why it's called a model is because it's always tentative. It's something that can be built upon. Mm-hmm. And so it might be that it needs a certain extension in order to, if we find that kind of interaction of a Higgs boson with dark matter particles, it will have to be extended to account for reality. Mm-hmm. It would be great. Mm-hmm. Will it happen? I don't know. It depends on what nature has in store.
And what we build, right? There are proposals out there now, mm-hmm. which we're discussing amongst ourselves. We take it very seriously when we talk about the future in our field, because it's a big investment for all of us.
And it's a long-term, very long-term.
Very long-term. The plans I see right now are talking about something 70 years, covering 70 years mm-hmm. to actually build the next scale. So, and there's different ideas out there. We've talked about building another ring that's much larger, higher energy, order magnitude higher energy. I use the term order magnitude again. That would mean one order is 10. And huge, and maybe up to 91 to 100 kilometers around, whereas the LHC is a small 27 kilometers around. Or other ideas like a linear collider, which could run with the same energy as the mass of the Higgs boson to produce lots and lots of Higgs bosons. So those are possibilities. There's also this idea of a muon collider that's out there, which could possibly run at that mass. I don't know. What do you think about the future for our field?
So I'm in an interesting state right now. I think our field, we've had a paradigm about how we're looking for new physics that the LHC has shown us is maybe not correct, right? So we had the Higgs boson, which we've been talking about, which we found, but we also had many predictions for, there should be new physics around the TV scale. We had a whole range of theories like that. So I actually think we're at a very interesting time, is there's a paradigm shift that's needed towards thinking. I mean, there are many possible options for it, but at least to me, I don't see which way we're going to go. So I preface mm-hmm. that by saying, and then we talk about, what collider should we build? And we talked all about the no-lose theorem. We were in this fantastic situation at the LHC, right? We said we had this thing, we knew which one to build, and we built it, and we found it to do it. We're not there now. And so I think we're in a stage where we need to go and explore as broadly as possible, because right now the theory is not clear. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's a time when experiment needs to lead the way to do it. So if it was up to me, I would go to search as far as possible to do it. There are many constraints. It's a complex space, and so you can't necessarily do that. But that's at least the way I think about it, because I think it's unknown, and we need to try and look as far as possible, and then we may find big answers that change things.
Yeah, I agree, especially because projects take so long. If you think about it, the Higgs boson was found like 50 odd years after it was predicted. During those 50 years, theory was guiding the way, right? Mm-hmm. And indeed, I totally agree with what Heather has said. We are now in a data-driven epoch, if you want. And in that case, the question is, what kind of tools are we building to gather data and to explore nature? And I don't think there's ever a promise that can be made that, we are going to find the... But that's the thing. If you don't look for it, if you don't try, you're definitely never going to find the... I think there was a sort of a consensus in the community that the next machine should be what we call a Higgs factory, which is you make collisions and lots of Higgses come out, because it is... It has not only this very central role, regardless of it having a central role in the theory, it has this very central role. It talks to many particles, as you were saying, Steve. We also do not understand how come there's only one. Is there only one? Mm-hmm. Who knows if there's only one? And changes in the properties predicted by the standard model for this particle can tell us whether there are more Higgs bosons, if there mm-hmm. are other interactions. For instance, measuring the total width is really cool, because the total width via some quantum mechanical trickery mm-hmm. is related to all the possible ways that the Higgs boson can decay into other particles. Mm-hmm. So if you would find something anomalous there, you know, some departure with respect to the standard model, it could be because it is decaying also into, I don't know, the dark matter particles, mm-hmm. if they're there. So all of these things, many people think of the Higgs boson as a sort of object of study. I think of it as a tool. So it's a tool that we can now go and try in different types of screws and different types of knobs and wrenches. So you just try it out and see exactly how does it operate in that particular context.
Very good. Let's leave it at that. That's a very nice conclusion there. I'm looking forward to these new accelerators wherever and whatever they may be. Andre David is a CERN physicist on the CMS experiment here on the Large Hadron Collider. Heather Gray is an associate professor at UC Berkeley and Berkeley Lab, working on the ATLAS experiment here on the Large Hadron Collider. Thank you both for coming here and being on Early Morning Coffee at CERN. Okay, Joni, it's time for you. You have a question for the audience.
So my question for you is that, what is the other important discovery that brought a CERN physicist Nobel Prize after offer the benchmark for the Higgs discovery?
Ah, okay. So we have Nobel Prize that was awarded to Peter Higgs, Francois Engler. Unfortunately, Robert Brout died the year before we discovered it. But before that, there had been a Nobel Prize at CERN. So tell us what that Nobel Prize was. And you said to send it to CERN social media, so at CERN, on pretty much any social platform, right? With hashtag EMC2. And you can also put comments in our YouTube channel. And you're going to be able to follow all of our podcasts on anywhere you get your podcasts. We look forward to seeing you again soon. Next time, we are going to probe into the experiment called LHC-B, which is a very interesting experiment because they don't just look at the quarks and the elementary particles, but they look at various combinations of these quarks, and they found a lot. So they've made a lot of discoveries, a big list of discoveries that have come from LHC-B, filling up our particle data group books with discoveries. So we'll be talking about that next time. So have a great time, and thank you for listening.